Lab Forum with Dennis Elsas and Bill Flanagan.
On Sirius XM's The Beatles Channel.
Help by The Beatles, of course. And we've been talking about Robert Freeman, the photographer who did so many of their classic album covers, including that one. And if you have a favorite Beatle album cover, join the conversation. We don't have time to take any more phone calls, but we love getting your email at fabforum, F-A-B-F-O-U-R-U-M, at SiriusXM.com, fabforum, F-A-B-F-O-U-R-U-M, at SiriusXM.com. So it is the Beatles Fab Forum, and I'm about to welcome our next guest. His name is Desmond Child, and it might not be a name that is 100% familiar to you, but I think in the next couple of minutes, you will say, oh, that Desmond Child. So let me go to a classic Top 40 radio promo, and that is, and the hits just keep on coming.
Shout to the heart, and you're to blame, darling, you give love a bad name.
Desmond Child, welcome to the Beatles Fab Forum.
Wow, that was fantastic. I was sitting there like, who wrote all those songs?
Well, that is Desmond Child, and he is the co-writer of all of those songs. And Desmond, what I was wondering is, it's Dennis Elsas, and what I was wondering is, does a day go by where you're not walking maybe in and out of a store or by a radio or watching a movie or something that you don't, I mean, what does it feel like when it gets to you unexpectedly, when suddenly you go, oh, yeah, I wrote that song?
It's usually set up so that I feel like the universe is giving me a message.
That's lovely.
So it's like if something's going on in my life and then I walk into a room and then there's the song, then I think like, okay, that's my answer.
That's my entrance music. Desmond, you know, one of the stories that I love, and I got to ask you to tell it, is that when you were a kid, when you were an aspiring songwriter and you had a partnership with a young woman singer, the two of you snuck into the 1972 National Association of Recording Merchants Convention, the NARM Convention, by disguising yourself as John and Yoko?
Well, we had been up at Woodstock making our first demo with Van Morrison's band. I had just turned 18.
Wait a second. How did you get Van Morrison's band to play on your demo?
Having like, you know, kind of like Bambi eyes and just like being really cute and begging. And we made friends and we were hanging out in Woodstock and, you know, we would dress all in black velvet and very kind of like goth, and we became like town celebrities. So people were willing to work with us. They thought we had star power.
Wow. Okay.
And so. But meanwhile, the truth is, we were working at an apple picking plant by day, you know, with migrant workers, and our car was a convertible that didn't have a back window, and we would be like freezing with mittens on trying to drive.
But you got to sell that image, and it worked.
And so, and when it got just too cold, we went back down to Miami Beach, and we decided to get into the NARM convention, but we didn't know how to get in. So we decided to pull a prank, and I got dressed all in white, and my hair was long like that, and I had a bit of a little beard, and then I had the granny glasses, and then she wore the big black hat, and her hair was long and brown, and she was shorter than me, and all in black, and we just, like, with our heads down, we just beelined it, and everybody just stepped aside. And then we could hear behind us, John and Yoko, John and Yoko, John and Yoko. So as soon as we got in, we saw all these set tables, and we saw Clive Davis, who was the president of Columbia Records at the time. And that he was our target, and there were two seats in this table next to him. We went over there, sat down, and we had like our backs to him. And then at the end of it, I stood up, he stood up, and he started laughing. He thought we were John and Yoko. And so that's when I pulled out my tape and I gave it to him. So that was 1972. And exactly 40 years later, in I think that was 2012, I got the Clive Davis Legend in Songwriting Award. And it was like, well, you give him a demo, and then 40 years later, he gives you an award.
And did he remember? I'm sure you'd seen him in between.
Oh, my God.
Did he remember the incident?
He did not remember, but it doesn't matter. He did send us a very nice letter rejecting our tape, which I've lost, you know, through the sands of time. But that was a wonderful, daring thing that we did.
That was, that's a fantastic way to do it. That's a great story. And I have to ask, and we got a lot of Beatles stuff to talk about with you, but you know, that medley we heard, you have written so many hits for so many artists that perfectly capture their personalities. I mean, Dude Looks Like a Lady sounds like something Steve Tyler heard people saying as he walked past them. I mean, You Give Love a Bad Name and Living on a Prayer, that is pure Bon Jovi. Livin' La Vida Loca is Ricky Martin's theme, and on, Joan Jett and Kiss and everybody else. I mean, is it like an actor? Do you go in and say, okay, let me put myself in the head of Steven Tyler. Let me put myself in the head of Joan Jett. What would Ricky Martin say to the world? Do you kind of do it like method acting?
Well, I don't think it's that kind of thought through. I just have a lot of inborn empathy, and my mother was a songwriter, so I didn't know that people didn't write songs. I mean, a song was always written in my house, and it usually reflected my mother's mood. So if she was sad, which was most of the time, she'd write these very sad songs, and if she was happy once in a while, she'd write a very happy song. So that was like a barometer of feeling.
Right.
So I go into a session with my hands open, usually with a title in my back pocket,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I just listen, and it's the power of listening. Tell me what's going on in your life, and pretty soon they're just spilling their guts, and there's your song. It gets spilt all over the blank piece of paper.
Wow. Well, you sure have an amazing gift for it. I mean, are there any people you come in and it just doesn't click? You know, you just say, hey, I've got a song for you. It's called Handsomest Man in the World. And, you know, and the guy goes, no, get lost. That has nothing to do with me. Do you ever just find that what you think might work for the artist is at odds with how they see themselves?
No, I mean, I haven't really encountered something like that. I mean, I once went to meet Dolly Parton.
Mm-hmm.
In Hollywood, in this very fancy, you know, Sandy Gallen's offices, everything was beige. And, you know, I went in there and she didn't seem too happy, like when I walked in. And I adore her. And she's like, anytime I've ever seen her, like the warmest person in the world. But that day, she had these cold eyes and she was like looking right through me. And it's like, why are you here? You're not a country writer.
Yeah.
You know, what is this all about? You know, I mean, she didn't say it, but she said it with her eyes. And so that was one of my fails. But
well, I can see that. I could imagine that some people who are songwriters feel like, hey, why are you bringing in the doctor? I don't need any help.
Well, you know, I was kind of called the song doctor, but not by the bands I work with, but by the rival bands who I didn't work with.
I see.
Because they wanted to kind of denigrate the songs that we were coming up with that were beating them on the charts. And the fact is that I don't doctor songs. I'm a collaborator, and the people I've written with, like John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, we have chemistry together, and we collaborate. Everybody's contributing and coming to life in those sessions. And so, you know, in a way, I'm more like a marriage counselor or something.
Right, right.
Because sometimes I'll walk in and those two people are kind of cold to each other. And then before you know it, we're all, you know, triple high-fiving with the great idea. I think sometimes people need like a third person to like they'll say something and then they'll look over and I'll either agree with them or I don't. You know, they're trying to find someone who will be on their side. And when it's just one against one, then it's just like heads will butt.
Desmond, I remember your name specifically because I first got introduced to your name as Desmond Child and Rouge. I played your records on the radio, and that was back in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, is it true that as Desmond Child and Rouge, you were playing at a New York club called Trax, and George Harrison came in to see you?
It's true. The word got backstage. It's like, George Harrison is in the audience. And so I peeked out, you know, from behind the curtain, and there he was, like those big white teeth, you know, the mustache and everything. And oh my God, I mean, I was like trembling. It's like one of the Beatles came to hear me sing. And he was like just so like, beaming the whole time. He got a real kick out of us. And so that's actually my second George Harrison connection. My first connection was when the Beatles went to Miami Beach. They were staying at the Deauville Hotel. And my mom, who was single at the time, and her beautiful sisters went over there and got invited to the after party. And my mom came back and she said that she sat next to George Harrison all night. And it was like, oh my God, I could be his love child or something, you know?
Now, you've just blown our minds three ways to Sunday. Did you get a chance to say that to George when he came to see
you? No, I didn't because, you know, right before the last encore, he got whisked away.
But
there's another interesting thing about my name. My original songwriting partner, her name was Debbie Wall, and mine was John Barrett. But we had come up with the idea to do a duet called Night Child. So I named her Virgil Knight, and then she named me Desmond Child. Desmond, because of the song Obladi Oblada.
Really? You're named after a
Desmond
Beatles song?
Had a
you
barrel...
may be George's love child, for all we know.
Desmond had a barrel in the marketplace, and that's where I got my name.
Well, that's a pretty good Beatles connection.
Right?
Now listen, I heard that you did a My Fab Four for the Beatles Channel, and you know where we ask famous guests to pick their four favorite Beatles songs. And the thing that struck me, and forgive me if I'm reading too much into this, you picked Eleanor Rigby, A Day in the Life, She's Leaving Home, and The Long and Winding Road. They're all songs about loneliness. Did you feel isolated as a kid? Did you find companionship in
isolated.
Beatles songs?
We lived in the projects in Liberty City. My mom's broken down car didn't even have gas in it. I'd go out to play with the kids in the schoolyard, and it was very rough. And I was kind of like an outcast. You know, I was Latino, which was already strange, you know, and I was gay, made me even more strange, and really, really poor and shy. And so I'd go, you know, back to the house, and at least we had a TV, and I'd just lose myself watching Hollywood, old black and white Hollywood films. And so that was my life for, you know, so long, it didn't seem like it would ever end. And then when I got to high school, I became Desmond Child and came to life.
Wow. So it was your music gave you a community you could join.
Yeah. I mean, I had gone with my cousin Iggy to, I think, the West Palm Beach Pop Festival. It was like a three-day thing. I saw Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and, oh my God, the Rolling Stones even showed up at 4 a.m. to play.
Wow.
You know, we were waiting all night in the rain. And, you know, when I saw that Janis Joplin and the way she had that crowd for 2.5 hours as she got drunker and drunker to the point where she was singing on the ground, like she couldn't pick herself up, but she was still singing with the Johnny Winters band behind.
Really?
And I said, okay, that's what I want to do.
So, luckily, hopefully not lying on the ground in the rain, unable to move.
So Desmond.
I've done that.
You know, you have. We all have favorite Beatles songs, and I know you must have favorite Beatles songs, too. You did the Beatles Fab. You know, you picked My Fab Four. But as a songwriter, right now, not as necessarily as a fan, as we all are, but as a songwriter, is there a particular song or songs that you just go, wow, I wish I had written that?
I would say the one I listened to over and over and over again when I was really little was Yesterday. Mm-hmm. And the way that song cycle just kept winding around and around, I was just fascinated with that, the way one section would lead into the next. And that song had a very melancholy melody and everything, and I think that song is pretty much one of the ones that made the most impact on me.
What did the Beatles understand? Forgive me, this is going to be like an essay question, but what did they understand about pop songwriting that you as an expert pop songwriter might see other bands missing? What do people leave out? I mean, every one of us gets lots of tapes from people and listen to this, and sometimes it's hard to say what it is that's not there. But what did you hear in the Beatles that you might have applied to your own songwriting technique?
Well, their inventiveness, was, without bounds. I mean, they just kept driving music forward and forward and forward at a time when they just could have been an oldies band playing,
Right, playing the first five hits over and
over. The first five hits over and over again. They didn't stop there, and they experimented. You know, they were the first to go to India and study with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and mind-expanding who knows what substances, all these things. They dressed differently, sometimes, they dress in one theme, and then they were always with those black suits and ties, and then all of a sudden they were in these silks and multicolored with beards and long hair. So they captured the public's imagination. And I think that just bottom line, the chemistry, with that band, and especially the writing competition between John and Paul, like many times, they didn't co-write, but they wanted to beat each other, in terms of who would write the next best song. And of course, both their deal was both their names would be on the same song. So you can tell whose song is whose just knowing those two characters and their musical styles. And I think that, they were just genius. They just tapped into genius. And they were geniuses. Paul is still alive. He's a genius. I just think that in that moment in time, with their youth and energy, and then being fed by the energy of the fans, they just kept it rolling as long as they possibly could.
Now, have you ever met McCartney?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I was at the Four Seasons Hotel last year, and he was being honored, I think, as Person of the Year or something. And I was waiting for an elevator, and all of a sudden he comes up next to me waiting for the same elevator, and coming out of the elevator was Julian Benetta, the producer of One Direction. I mean, the guy's a genius, and I knew him when he was 14 years old. He was my next door neighbor. So anyway, he comes out, Desmond, and all this. And I just, put my hand on his chest and like push him back and then jumped into the elevator with Paul. I didn't even say anything. I just like pushed him away. Oh, I was not going to miss that elevator.
Yeah, him you can see anytime. But
I had to call him and say, I'm so sorry. But I mean, this was like one of those kind of the Hulk, like brute force, like pushes.
Now did you get to talk to
elevator,
McCartney in the elevator?
I looked at Paul, and he looked at me, and he went, hello. And I was like, hello. And all of a sudden his fork was there, and ding, and he walked out. So he and I were like 1 foot away from each other.
You know what's beautiful is that with all your success and all your accomplishments in music, that you can still get that fan excitement about meeting Paul McCartney in an elevator.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's beyond the beyond, you know, how great he is and how great they were. And I love that he gets out there and he is involved. He's an active participant. And he doesn't just sit up in a mansion somewhere. He's, like, in there doing stuff every day. I love that. And that's how I am. You know, I just turned 66.
Wow.
You
know, I remember when, like Dennis, when Desmond Child and Rouge came out, and very high expectations, a lot of high, it's like, here comes the big new thing. And you were still quite young. Did you feel when it didn't sell the way people thought it was going to sell, when Desmond Child and Rouge did not become the new sensation, that, oh, I've had my chance, it's over? Or did you always know you were going to stay in the biz?
Well, it did throw me for a loop, but, you know, one of the mistakes I made was not sticking with my group, because we really were unique. But the people around us didn't understand us. The label didn't. Our managers didn't. And we didn't. We didn't understand how great we were. And we were doing things that nobody had thought of before, putting rock guitars on dance beats.
Yeah.
You know, and one of those, you know, one of the songs I wrote at that period of time was with Paul Stanley of Kiss. And he was a fan of ours. And he'd come to that Tracks gig, by the way. He was there when George Harrison was there. And he said, do you want to write a song with me? And I said, sure, like, let's try. And so I hoodwinked him into the idea of, like, this four on the floor dance beat with heavy guitars. And, you know, I Was Made for Loving You was born.
That's interesting, because it's a few years before Thriller. And that, I mean, it, in 1979, it's still sort of disco versus rock. A couple of years later, it was dance music, and you could have Eddie Van Halen playing with Michael Jackson, and everybody accepted it. But you were maybe just a year or two ahead of the curve on that.
Right, but the I think the Kiss song paved the way.
Yeah, I think it did. I think,
and you know, to this day, I mean, Gene hates the song, but you know, he went and did that movie Why Him, you know, and he sang it just fine for the coin.
Well, you know, we all occasionally do something for the coin. But in that case, I think we can say objectively, it was very good for Kiss to get out of their lane and expand a little bit. You know, another thing I heard you talk about once was the fact that Eleanor Rigby and songs like that were story songs. And that's certainly something McCartney did very, very well with Penny Lane and Obla Dee and Paperback Writer. And here's what just hit me about an hour ago before we came on the air, was how many of the big hits of that time, from Love Child to Leader of the Pack to Harper Valley PTA to you know, Papa Was a Rolling Stone to In the Ghetto, were story songs. I mean, they really had a beginning, middle, and an end.
Well, that's what I always knew. And so, you know, for me, it was natural. And also, I was very influenced by Laura Nyro.
Yeah.
I named my son after her. He's not happy about that, but NYRO. I have twin sons, Roman and Nyro. And
Roman and Nyro.
Wow.
That would give someone a different impression of what they were named after.
And, you know, Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
Very strong. Elton John. And those songs, those lyrics, you know, told stories, you know, Tiny Dancer, all of that, you know, it's like, it's just, to me, that's what keeps someone in the song. They want to know what comes next.
Right.
If you're just cutting and pasting the same thing over and over again, over a loop, it's so linear. And those songs may be cool because that person was cool that day,
right,
or that week, or that year. But then, do those songs stand the test of time?
Right.
No.
No, that's a great point.
They don't.
It's a great point. Desmond's Tom Frangione. Wanted to ask you, you know, you were in New York. You're talking about the George visit at the 79 gig and working with Kiss, obviously a very New York band. Around that time, 79, 80, when you were living in New York and John kind of came back, Did you have any chance to run into him maybe at the Hit Factory or walking around New York or anything like that?
Well, we were neighbors, and that club Tracks was on 72nd Street. He was on 72nd and Central Park West. I was across the street at the Oliver Cromwell. And I'd pass him and Yoko all the time, and he would like kind of nod, and he wouldn't know who I was, but he was friendly to everybody. He was just one of the neighbors. Wow. And I was sitting on my bed, and my window was open, and I heard those five cannon shots.
Oh my God!
You know, in the coming from the alcove of the Dakota, and I hit the floor. I literally thought the bullets were going to fly, and within seconds the police were there. I looked outside. I saw that police car drive away with him, you know, because there was no time for an ambulance or anything like that. And that was a very difficult, you know, period. And that night, I went and hung out at the coffee shop on the corner. It was a Greek coffee shop on 72nd and Columbus, and that was sort of headquarters for the media.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, kept going around talking to people. Then as I came home, it started, you know, raining, kind of like a drizzle turned into a rain. There were like 300, 400 people out in front of the Dakota holding black umbrellas. And it was like, you know, looked like London or something, right? Mm. And so then I went upstairs and I started writing this song called Dakota that goes, rain falls softly on this bloody street. Wash away, wash away, wash away our sins tonight. Why must there be this senseless killing? I'm ashamed to be human tonight.
Wow, strong stuff.
Desmond, in a totally different direction, in sort of a celebration, you are going to have a new album out called Desmond Child Live?
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I had my group, and then, you know, the group broke up, as they would, for a lot of reasons. And I started, you know, working with bands, and then pretty soon I became a studio rat, just working with one band after the other, producing, writing. For, you know, decades went by. And then I just decided, you know what, I think I'm just going to sing again. And so this happened a couple of years ago, and I got all my friends together at a little club in New York called Feinstein's, 54 Below.
Sure.
That was right underneath the original 54, Studio 54. And I think that was the orgy room and where people took drugs, where they built this club.
Tom,
but now
is
it's
that
very
true?
Chic. Now it's very, very nice with booths and, you know, very, very beautiful everything. And so it has a fantastic sound system. So I brought all my friends together and we did three nights. And that's what my album is, Desmond Child Live, with special guest Lena Hall, the Tony Award-winning actress for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Desmond Child and Rouge had a reunion.
Oh, that's great.
So we did a song called Love on a Rooftop, and Tabitha Fair and this fantastic young singer and rocker Justin Benlolo, he took all the high parts, so it wasn't that hard for me. And so now what I have here is a jewel of those three nights all put together, and I'm very proud of it because it's different when you hear kind of like more like the original performer, not the original performer, you know, one of the original writers, just do their interpretation of it, of the songs. And you know, it's been very fulfilling, and now it's out, and I'm, you know, I performed also at the American Songbook Series at Lincoln Center last February, and I was on a PBS special called Live at the Kate. And you know, it's, I have this new career as a performer. Maybe I still have a chance.
Well, what does it feel like to devote yourself to that for your youth and into your 20s, and then go away from it for 30 years or so, and then come back to it? What's different about it?
Well, you know, it's like I'm a person that pretty much stays in the now, so I never really look back that much. But I, you know, guess there was another job and another job, and I just showed up for it and then did my best, and one day turned into the next and to the next. You know, it just kind of went by. And then finally, you know, my husband and I moved to Nashville, and we raised our sons here. They're 17 now and seniors. And it was like, okay, you know, I put a lot of time into being a parent also. You know, it's not the greatest to be a parent and always be away somewhere
right. On
tour or something.
And I think a lot of people made the right choice. Yeah,
and also,
I think a lot of people have that experience too when the kids start getting into college age of going, wait, where was I?
Yeah.
Where was I when I got into
this? Where was I? You know, the thing is, though, because I wrote on so many albums, and those were all like, every song was like a bird flew away, the truth is that we've added it up. I've sold over 500 million records.
Wow.
And not any single one of the artists I work with have sold that much. And, you know, now with the streaming and YouTube downloading, that's in the billions. So, you know, my husband and I call it living room on a prayer.
Well, because we're on the Beatles channel, all right, because we're on the Beatles channel, and because we have you, Desmond Child, as our guest, as we say goodnight, I'm going to ask you to introduce a song which you didn't write or co-write, but you have a personal connection with. And Desmond, you are the DJ right now. Please do the introduction. I'll bet you know exactly what we want to hear.
Well, I want to play my namesake, Obla Di Obla Da. Desmond has a barrel in the marketplace.